Once again, we have Cynthia Ozick, who is most recently the author of Foreign Bodies. Cynthia, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm well, thank you.
And thanks so much for letting us into your house. It was a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you for coming all the way from Brooklyn.
Oh, believe us, it's the closest thing we get to a vacation doing these things. I wanted to start off with the inevitable topic, Henry James. I want to do so through a rather roundabout way. In Henry James's famous essay, The Art of Fiction, James is strenuously opposed to the Besantian idea of fiction that's dictated by a conscious moral purpose. James declares that the air of reality is the supreme virtue of a novel. And in your essay, James, Tolstoy, and My First Novel, which is contained in The Din in the Head, you write about the contemporary reader's impatience with large chunks of dialogue. And I'm wondering if it's possible to reconcile that Jamesian notion in The Art of Fiction with this concern that you have in your essay for the contemporary reader and this need for almost instant gratification. What is the air of reality for today? And I'm going to get into how this ties into Foreign Bodies, which is a deceptively breezy book. You know?
Well, I think it wasn't large blocks of dialogue. Yeah. It was large blocks of prose.
Yeah.
Dialogue is lively, easy,
sure,
quick reading. So it's the large blocks of descriptive prose, the 19th century novel, which has to begin with a traveler and describe the village and the road and everybody meets on the way, and the George Eliot completion complex, which James had to a very small degree and used it tellingly, I think, when he described, I think, in Portrait of a Lady, a summer afternoon under the trees and tea time and that kind of spread out, so to speak, introduction. But it is true that readers are impatient today. And I think the reason for it is obvious, because we've been accustomed to be interrupted by commercials in a narrative on TV. And then came the email revolution, which reduced people to grunts. And then came the even briefer grunts that I'm not familiar with of, what is it, Twitter?
Yeah.
And texting. And the strange iconic or icons, not iconic, but icons of abbreviation and so on. And I think this has accustomed us to seize life and particularly reading in snatches. And this may be the cause of it. And of course, everything I say is trite because everybody has noticed this. And I think everyone has suffered from it. It's true that when we had film, there was something leisurely about film. It borrowed from, in a sense, this panning thing borrowed from the novel, and then the novel borrowed it back. But the novel is in a kind of situation now where it doesn't know how to capture a reader's attention.
And is the way to, I suppose, capture that air of reality is to really compress story in the manner that you have done with Foreign Bodies, do you think? Is this your sort of proposed solution to the problem?
Well, I never thought about it. Sure. And as a matter of fact, I did not think about The Ambassadors very much. I mean, as far as the plot of The Ambassadors goes, it's the plot of the Odyssey. I think it's the plot of every folktale or fairy tale where the youngest son, the youngest prince, goes out into the world to look for a new situation to change his life. I mean, that is so archetypical that James wasn't doing anything new with that. What interested me, and which is why I mentioned The Ambassadors in the first place, and I'm beginning to regret it more and more for lots of reasons, but was the difference between how America and Europe have seen one another and each other since the end of the 19th century and the early part, since before the First World War. And after 1914, everything changed. And it certainly changed with the Second World War. And for James and for America in general, for Emerson, Europe was this brilliant center of high civilization, and America, raw, provincial. This essay that on Hawthorne that James wrote has such a list of everything that Europe has and that America doesn't have. He even mentioned sports, which was kind of surprising. He said no Epsom, no Ascot, and no thatched cottages, and no aristocracy, and no monarchy. Well, we could do without the monarchy, but the contrast between James's view and the view of American society at that time of Europe and what Europe has become and America has become since is such an interesting reversal. And that was my point, not the plot, not the plot.
Well, I want to also point out one thing I noticed. The Ambassadors isn't the only James work that is riffed on in Foreign Bodies. You have one moment where you have the character with the two missing fingers, which reminded me, of course, of the Jolly Corner and how Spencer sees himself as an alter ego. Of course, you know, Dr. Faustus is brought up in the last 100 pages of the book, which really can't even be called Ambassadors-like because at that point the story has gone into a completely different direction. You say that you feel regret for this, what seems to me a marketing concern. This was like, hey, it's Cynthia Ozick reworking the Ambassadors. To my great surprise, there are these other influences there. The question is if this book is in some sense a collage, what is the degree that Henry James informs the writing of this text? And what is the degree that, say, Thomas Mann and other Henry James stories? What is the James ratio, I suppose, for inspiration?
Well, what about the E.M. Forster ratio?
Yes, that's true.
Because that letter, which is chapter one, was not there until I was actually working. Someone will get that. Right. That first chapter with the letter is from B to Marvin was not there until I was doing the final typing to send to the publisher, just going over it, and suddenly I saw, what am I doing here? That belongs right at the beginning. And where did I get it from? I got it from Howard's End.
Yeah.
I mean, that was an overt, out-and-out steal.
Yeah.
But it was thrilling to have done that because then I avoided beginning with those large blocks of prose. But essentially, I wasn't thinking about the structure or its relation to any prior reading of mine, except at that one moment. And I think all these things really reflect the contents of your mind, and they're not very conscious. I will admit that when I referred to B as an emissary or an ambassador and so on, yes, that was conscious.
Yeah.
But it was also inevitable, given the fact that she was sent as an emissary. But what has really disturbed me, and maybe maybe I should let you come to this rather than jump ahead, but what has disturbed me is the kind of literal one-on-one kind of matching that has been going on in some reviews. I find that kind of literalism very curious. Why would one want to take such a junior high view?
Well, because we're in an increasingly childish age, I suppose. but you're talking about a schematic, things must line up this way, and certainly that's not the way fiction is created, and certainly that's not the way that fiction is read. The question, though, I suppose, is going back to collage, does something like, for example, taking a few ideas in terms of the plot framework of the Ambassadors, putting that 50 years later is enough
to completely jumble and unscramble and scramble up everything so that it really becomes a completely new novel. I mean, is maybe, I suppose, the reason why there's this, I suppose, this schematic approach to this book is largely because we're demanding some precedent, or we're demanding that it's an iteration of something. I don't know. I'm getting lost here in the questioning. But
but there is no scheme, and yeah. Maybe your phrase collage, though it takes me by surprise because I had never wasn't aware of it and didn't mean it and didn't plan it. But it may be a good description. For instance, there was something else I was very interested in. I have a friend in London who is a Conrad obsessive. And in fact, his name is David Miller, and he's about to publish a book based on the death of Conrad, which is full of biographical information about Conrad. And he and I have had a James Conrad clash going on for quite a while.
This goes back to dictation, no doubt.
Yes, indeed. He was the inspiration for that. Precisely right. He has sometimes managed to convert me, but like any new convert, I have relapses and I'm a backslider and so on. But one day he said to me, and this was a little bit aside from the James Conrad fight, he said, "There's no music in your books." And I was taken aback, and I know that though I had 10 years of piano lessons and never once practiced in those 10 years, and I know that I, like B, am a musical imbecile. But I took that as a challenge, and I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to remedy that and start thinking about music? And I wanted to have a musician, and then I thought, no, I'll do even better, and I'll have a composer. And then I met somebody who was married to a film composer, and I thought, that is really interesting. And I got in touch with the film composer, and he used the expression, which I plagiarized. He said, "Here in Hollywood, I am low man on the totem pole," and described himself as capable of abysses, depths, deeps of imaginings, musical imaginings, but confined by the rules of the industry. So that interested me almost as much as Europe versus America, Europe then, Europe now, America then, America now. And it's in a sense a completely separate theme. So when you say collage, I begin to see that maybe even mosaic. Yeah. So I mean, I never thought of it. I mean, you're arousing a consciousness where none lived before.
Well, okay, let's clarify what we mean by collage. Typically, collage is cutting and pasting. With this, I think it's more of a conceptual collage. You've always been very careful with your language in your books, and I think that what happens is you get one idea riffing off of another to the point where, I mean, I don't, to my mind, it seems more collage-like simply because there are so many concepts packed into this 250-page book that what initially seems a sort of tension between old world and new world transforms into something in which, you know, rather interestingly, something completely new. I mean, the book, one thing that nobody has really remarked upon is the fact that we do go through the summer months, Thanksgiving, and at the end of the book, we are at a new year, matching whatever sort of fusion is going on between the old world and the new world, whether culture can be found in California or Paris or New York. I mean, it's almost as if the novel is almost making a case for a universality of culture. Almost, now that I think about it, a kind of a response to, like, you know, the infamous C.P. Snow, Two Cultures. By collage, I guess the question is, how do you control a book that becomes this complicated when one concept leads into another? I mean, there's a lot in this book, and I'm wondering what steps you take to confine the endless flow of ideas to make sure that it manages to confine itself into a cohesive narrative.
Well, I suppose this is why Michael Upchurch in the Seattle Times said choppy.
Yeah.
It wasn't choppy for me. It was fascinating, actually, to go from character to character, with B as the unifying connector. But I think the mood, the underlying thing, does come back to my sense of, well, let me begin this way. I said it in 1952. For a reason. First of all, in 1952, America was imperfect. There was McCarthyism, which was a terrible, terrible, scary, frightening time. And when you would feel that fascism was about to come to America, there was the Korean War. The civil rights movement had not begun. There was barely an inkling of it. And Jim Crow was everywhere where it was. The America was confused and mixed up. On the other hand, America had just saved Western Europe from Nazism, was soon, despite McCarthy, going to watch the decline of the Soviet Union. And Europe then, for me, in 1952, when there was still these DPs, 1952 is a year when finally, the United States gave visas to refugees from the Holocaust. And all these things were happening in that year. And at the same time, there was a second generation trying to be the lost generation yet again, and that was going on in Paris, and Paris was the center of that, and Paris was the center of existentialism, and Sartre and Gide, et cetera, and Simone de Beauvoir were big deals in Paris, and it was and modern art established itself in America. In those 50s and so on. So, and of course earlier. But all this cultural tumult, over it for me hung this mist of smoke from ash. Yeah. And so the reversal from the raw provincial America into a cultural powerhouse, and despite Korea, despite McCarthyism, a land by contrast of virtue, speaking of moral positions, this is why the ambassadors was a template of opposition in a sense, and this is what I cared about. But because the question of art was also part of 1952, and I wanted for the first time to see what it would be to explore the world of music, which I had never touched before. So all these things came together, but the unifying thing of all of them, I think, including the music, including B's inability to be artfully expressive herself and having to do it vicariously, which is what America had been before in Emerson's time and Hawthorne's time. And this is what James was speaking about in his essay on Hawthorne. And George Steiner has written a lot about this, about America as Europe's museum. Well, America isn't Europe's museum anymore. America houses the museums of American art. And so all these things seemed unified for me, strangely enough, by the fumes of human ash in Europe. That unified it for me, including the cultural part.
Going back to this issue of music, this is really interesting because the one thing I noticed in this book, whenever a particular voice
whether it be an American one or particularly an English one, or even the musicality of the airplane in this book. It's almost as if by Leo shifting to movie music, you in turn as a writer are focusing, despite your professment that you are a musical illiterate. but it seems to me that you are very capable of observing the sounds of a voice, whether a voice sounds like something that is battered. There's a number of references throughout the book. I mean, you almost flip the pages wanting to determine how someone's voice will transform or how it will actually be revealed to the timbre of it will be revealed to be something by through a simile. And I'm curious why voices were really the way for you to kind of I suppose zero the needle here in terms of the musical pursuit of this novel.
Yeah, the joy of dialogue. Yeah. Oh, dialogue. It took me such a long time to learn how to do dialogue, and I think I learned it from a single book, which was Graham Greene's The Heart of the Matter, which I actually studied to see how he made it concise and dramatic. And the voices, I think once you know the character, you have the voice. I suppose you could say that once you have the voice, you know the character, but I don't think it works like that, not for me. Once you know the character, you can hear the character speak. And of course, they all speak in their own voices. I don't know whether that's related to music. I think that's more related to seeing, because you see the character, and if you see visually the character, then if I am looking at you, the voice that comes out of you is naturally yours because I see you.
Yeah.
Whereas music is this mystery of mathematics. Even Confucius, and I shouldn't say even Confucius, but including Confucius, music and math go together. And that's a wonder about E.M. Forster. He's one of the few writers who was very musical.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously musical. And that's in his writing as well. But I think the link with writing is more painting, and we see this so interesting. John Updike had the ability to draw and write. Thackeray, Kipling, there are others, I can't think of them now, but there's so many linkages in writing and art. In other words, the pen and the eye. Whereas music is abstract math. So that's where the voices come from the eye, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned Greene, because of course we know him for the colon. And in terms of looking at your dialogue in this book, what is rather interesting is that sometimes you have almost a Marion Wiggins-like dash, and sometimes you actually have the quotes. I'm curious as to the methodology behind that, how that developed.
Yeah, well, that was pretty simple. I needed to have a dialogue in the historic present, so to speak, and dialogue before then. So for the earlier dialogue, I used the dash to distinguish it from the dialogue that's occurring in the now, even though the now is in the past tense, because I have to confess, I have a lot of trouble with our common currency of the present tense, despite those great books of Rabbit.
Huh.
I was once standing in a group of writers and was so humiliated because I mentioned my prejudice against writing in the present tense, and Updike was standing at my right elbow and said, "Well, my Rabbit books are in the present tense." That was not a good moment.
Why the aversion specifically to present tense? It's used a lot more, I think, now than it was 30 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's ubiquitous. Yeah. It's ubiquitous. I don't know. It just seems that it spoils storytelling because it escapes from the magical once upon a time. This happened once. It isn't happening. If it's happening now, then there's almost no history in it. Yeah. It destroys the past. And then, of course, you see that writers who write in the present tense and then they have to go back and deal with the past, you see that they then have to revert to the past tense anyway.
Yeah.
And it's it has a kind of inconsistency, and it's simply unpleasant to read.
You're saying, I suppose, that a novel really should present itself almost as a sense of history.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a story that happened, not a story that's happening. And I guess that really needs to be explored. Why should a story that happened be better than a story that's happening? I don't know. Help me.
Well, I think when you have a situation like, there was a book by Elliot Perlman called Seven Types of Ambiguity, named, of course, after the great text. And it opens with, to my mind, I mean, I like the book, but it has this really absurd situation because it's written in the present tense and the narrator's going, he's hitting me. Which when I read this, I was going, this is just utterly preposterous. And it immediately takes me out of the story.
Right.
It's like, you know, if he hit him, right, or but he's hitting me, it's like, wait
then
a minute.
Then how can you be writing?
How can I be participating in this? I mean, but with the past tense, you can feel a greater sense, perhaps, of participation in the activity. Even though
you can believe in it.
Yes.
You can believe in it. And I mean, it really helps the suspension of disbelief if you present it as a history.
Yeah.
And isn't this sort of the beginning of the modern novel? You know, my man Friday.
Yeah.
we're supposed to believe that.
Yeah.
And we do because it's written like a history. Yeah. No, I think you hit it when you said it has to do with history.
Yeah.
And maybe that is the problem, if there is a problem with much of American writing today, that it is rather amnesiac.
Yeah.
I wonder, you know, one of what I regard, and this is really an extreme statement, as perhaps this is such an exaggerated statement. I think A Passage to India can count as the greatest novel of the 20th century, which is a terrible thing to say when you think of Ulysses and Proust and Mann, et cetera, et cetera. But something enormous happens in that book. It has two elements. It has politics, which we can call history, and it has mysticism. The mystery of being at its most enigmatic root. And I mean R-O-O-T, but maybe R-O-U-T-E also. But the politics is obsolete. It's dead. I mean, India is a booming, thriving, free country with wonderful writers coming out of it writing in English, thanks to imperialism and colonialism, and which doesn't need to be praised, but maybe that's a kind of silver lining. And yet, it's a great, great novel. And what I notice here is when books deal, it doesn't matter, you know, Republican, Democrat, Tea Party, whatever the politics is, whatever side you take, whatever your political view is, I would think you have to be very careful when you put it in novels because it will make your book dead the minute, 5 seconds after it's born. I mean, if you're going to bash Bush in a novel, you've killed your novel. No one will care 10 years from now.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if you're going to, this may sound preposterous, if you're going to praise Sarah Palin in a novel, nobody's going to care. Well, maybe not even now.
Yeah.
But this is an American problem, I think.
Yeah.
Too much present tense.
It's not just present tense, though. I think of this dilemma in relation to Richard Powers's Generosity, which is a really extraordinary novel. But on the other hand, when it came out, all the technology that it presented is now instantly obsolete.
I didn't think of it in terms of technology.
Yeah,
that
technology,
too.
But also the world. And it's supposed to be set in the not so distant, you know, in very quick future. Mm-hmm. And so this is quite interesting to me that it's almost, and going back to the dilemma we were talking about earlier about your essay and trying to go ahead and make something accessible for the reader, I'm wondering if by delimiting the possibilities, we can really get that sense of what the real is, or we have to introduce more prohibitions, no politics, no brand names, no present tense, and your chapters have to be mercilessly short.
No. First of all, I wasn't trying to help the reader.
Yeah.
I was mad at the reader who was impatient.
Yeah.
Now my other thought is gone. What did you just say?
Oh, we were talking about like whether
technology.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Technology. I wouldn't say make a list of more and more regulations and prohibitions. No, because then look at A Passage to India. It's there. It's dead, but doesn't matter. So that's the ingenuity and the genius of Forster to make that happen. It's not that you can't bash Bush in a novel today, but you can't bash Bush, period, and not have an overarching metaphysic to include it, which is so that overarching metaphysic will then reduce your political thing to a dried up little worm, and it won't interfere with the glory of the novel.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I mean, I wanted to actually talk with you about going back to the air of the real that we were talking about. This book has a lot of very interesting surreal qualities. I want to just, first of all, name a few. The thick necks really intrigued me. There are lots of thick necks throughout Foreign Bodies. There's, you know, for example, the faceless homunculus with a thick neck that lands in B's lap. Julian is plump, and you describe the clutch of anger in Julian's neck. You describe statues with thick marble necks where pulses once throbbed. When remembering this mysterious Alfred, who we don't quite know what the deal is, but I like that. You have Julian contemplating how it felt marvelous to have Alfred's arms around his neck. There's the encounter with B late in the book. Marvin's chin thickened, reconnoitering as if measuring the distance from one wall to another. I mean, he's getting up and bolting out of the chair, but you get the whole neck imagery there. And there's even the check in the book at the end is even described as thick and light as a leaf. Thickness and thick necks in particular just bristle throughout the novel really interestingly. We have a sturdy and dependent conduit between body and head. And the fact that Julian, of all people, even has a thick neck and he's a young guy is really interesting because normally we associate thicker necks as you get older, you thicken your neck. It lends this really interesting surreal touch to that works hand in hand with some of the cartoonish depictions of America. But they're not that cartoonish, but you can buy them enough. And I'm wondering how the neck thing came about and whether you really were thinking in terms of the neck as just the between the head and the body. You have very smart people who are having bizarre things happen to their body throughout the course of the book. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I never did think of that. I was utterly unaware of it. And I remember in our last conversation, you startled me with these amazing recognitions that I didn't recognize. But while you were speaking of it now, I was remembering that there are a lot of necks in Middlemarch,
yes,
especially on women. They are always twisting their necks. And there's one twist of neck you left out, which really came to me as a conscious reminiscence of Middlemarch, and that is Iris. When she first visits B, she is twisting her neck and looking around. That's one neck you didn't mention.
I got tons of notes if you want me to dig out all the necks.
That is interesting. Why would that occur to any writer who's working out of the chaos of the unconscious and you don't know what you're going to find? I don't know. Maybe because writing is a noose. And you're feeling a little strangled as you struggle? No, I don't know the answer, but it is certainly an astonishing observation. This is what is known as close reading.
Yeah, well, I also wanted to talk about, you know, I had mentioned the two missing fingers earlier, but there's also a kind of descriptive mitosis I wanted to bring up. You have of Lily B sees a double crease etched into her forehead, two cut off railroad tracks, and then I don't want to give anything away, but Margaret is contending with the pebble in her shoe, and she's concerned with the gap appearing in the two parallel columns of cars charging in opposite directions. So you have these dichotomies that somehow make their way into physical qualifiers, almost as if the people are being scarred by the mark of two. I'm curious
well,
how that came.
Well, in the case, yes, those are deliberate. In the case of Lily, those two railroad tracks are the tracks leading into Auschwitz. And many people have them. It comes from Frowning, these two marks here. And you can see them as railroad tracks on a person like Lily. The cut-off fingers, I think I simply was maiming somebody who had been in medical experiments. But the pebble is something different. The pebble is a foreign body. And I was deliberately playing on the notion of a foreign body, that this foreign body caught in her foot is lethal and kills her when she slips on some kind of grease in the road as she's trying to cross. And that she would have gotten through that double gap if not for the foreign body in her shoe. And everybody in this novel, and this was conscious, is a foreign body to everybody else. Lily is a foreign body to Marvin, a foreign body that he wishes to expel. He is married, culturally speaking, and she, him, a foreign body. They are culturally foreign to one another. And by the way, her name, Breckinridge, I did, again, consciously borrow from a man named Breckinridge Long. Is the name familiar to you?
Oh, I'm afraid not.
Yeah, Breckinridge Long was instrumental in the Roosevelt administration when there was some pressure to bring in the refugees and save them from being murdered. And he was very instrumental in a very nasty activist way to prevent Jews from coming into the United States and being saved. So I use that name. When I said she has relatives in the State Department, that was kind of an allusion. But very private to me. A few people with long memories, have caught that. So there are, it's true. I mean, it's so interesting that you're selecting details, some of which are conscious, and those I can easily acknowledge. I recognize them. I recognize how aware I was of them. But when you speak of thick necks, that really sets you to wondering where does that come from? Where does that come from? I mean, it's in there somewhere, but in that roil of chaos, but what does it mean to repeat it again and again? And I suppose there is some meaning, and don't know what it is.
It's fascinating, because I mean, they crop up almost every chapter, right? And it's...
No idea.
I was almost expecting a decapitation at some point.
But one of the glories, one of the wonders, one of the miracles of Bellow's writing is that he's almost a phrenologist. Yeah. And with Bellow, what crops up, you're just making me remember this now, are heads. They're domes very often. They have declivities in the top of the head. Ravelstein's bald dome has craters in it, like a moon. And he has so much physical description. And I think a lot of that has vanished from American writing. And it's interesting because this is related to the question of the present tense. If you're writing in the present tense, why don't you notice more how people look? And what's happening is you notice less. You're presented with a character through a name and a presence, but the presence is not given to you in any physical detail. And yeah. And so you're not seeing enough.
You know, I just talked about this issue of Susan Strait. I remarked to her that in her books, and she deals, of course, with poverty and race and really gritty topics, but I remarked that many of her characters are scarred, not just thin, but scarred. And she was very attentive in her last book in putting, you know, dents and crenellations in the forehead, which I found really fascinating. And maybe, aside from the present tense, we're also talking about perhaps a reluctance to pursue certain topics. I mean, working class fiction right now in particular, I think, is it exists, but it's not as celebrated, I think, as it once was. We had dirty realism, you know, 20 years ago. But these days, the dirty realists carry on, but they don't always get their essays. And a lot of that may have to do with shrinking book space. But I'm wondering how much of these details really relates possibly to one's station in life, and whether your tendency to also dwell on this also comes from a concern for these characters' stations in life, I think.
Mm. Well, sure. If we're dealing with scarred people who have survived atrocities, we will see their scars. But also, and this, I think, is something one can learn from Bello, that the interior scars also show after a while in the face and in the stance of the body. I mean, we are these aging mammals, and everything internal begins to everything that we've experienced begins to, what shall we say, develop a physical manifestation after a time. It's that every character then becomes physical and shows what we are shows.
Yeah.
What we are is evident. This, I guess, is the story of Dorian Gray, trying to reverse that and to hide that, but it can't be hidden. It can't be hidden. And if you write about human beings, then you really must show them physically, because if you don't show them physically in some detail, you're not showing them.
Yeah. I wanted to remark on the... I'll get to that point in just a bit. I did want to actually talk about the film Whispering Winds, mm-hmm. which is what the movie that Leo Coopersmith is scoring. To my mind, I immediately thought, oh, well, this is Douglas Sirk's, you know, Written on the Wind. But I also realized that there was, in fact, a movie called Whispering Winds.
Yeah,
I imdb'd it, and I was, like, shocked. You know, you had mentioned that a lot of this came from the movie composer friend and all that. But I'm wondering if you based this guy on anyone specific. Frank Skinner is the guy who composed for Written on the Wind. But there was also, in this James Flood movie from 1929 called Whispering Winds, Erno Rappi was the composer. And interestingly enough, he died in 1945, which makes it really interesting. And he was the head conductor of the Radio City Symphony Orchestra. And he also did an arrangement of Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody number 13. So I guess you weren't aware of any of this, but I'm wondering...
Us musical imbeciles aren't.
Well, I mean, but from a movie standpoint, why did you select the name Whispering Winds?
I thought it sounded silly enough to be, you know, a romantic Technicolor shipwreck movie.
Yeah.
No, it had no reference at all. I'm really too uninformed to have had any reference, so of course I was utterly taken by surprise when I discovered there was actually such an alliterative movie title, but based on no information or knowledge.
When you work on a novel, do you often have this situation where you come up with something and then it comes true and then you were astonished?
Yes.
By it?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, in most dreadful ways it has happened. Absolutely. This is, yes.
Well, like such as what?
Well, let's see if I can abstract it a little from its actual history. Someone called me up and said, you are immoral and you should be ashamed of yourself because you have written about a character whom everyone recognizes and you have made him an adulterer. And this was true. The character was recognizable, and I did make him, in fiction, an adulterer. But the reason I got this phone call was that the person who called was close to this person, was close to the adulterer, and knew of the adultery, and therefore accused me of immorality in exposing him.
Yeah.
But I made it up.
Yeah.
And then it was true. I found out it was true. And this has happened a number of times. Why? I don't know.
Every couple of years, someone calls you up and calls you immoral? Is
that well, not maybe that's the only time I've gotten it so overtly and directly, and I'm sure it's happened other times as well. I mean, writers are, you know, wild animals.
Yeah. To what do you attribute this capacity for hitting things on the nose unexpectedly?
I'm a soothsayer?
Yeah.
No. Who knows? It may be simply just the lottery of imagination.
Can research often get in the way? Because clearly with this book, there are a lot of things going on.
If there's no research, though. There's no research at all in this book. And in fact, if you would do research, I don't think you would find the Center for Emigration in Paris as ever having existed. A baron who is related on the maternal, that is the Jewish side, to Proust, who wants to cleanse Paris of foreign Jews. I don't think this ever existed.
No, it didn't. I checked.
But it does resonate with Vichy. It does resonate with the fact that it was the Paris police who rounded up the Jews and sent them to Auschwitz. So it does resonate with French history. So sometimes, is it in rhetoric, is it synecdoche?
Yeah.
Which a part for the whole or something? Yes. So,
maybe it's a matter of finding something that is just specific enough but doesn't entirely tell the whole story, and then the reader is permitted to fill that detail in with imagination.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
One last question. I actually wanted to ask you about the fairy tales. You have Laura reading from A Treasury of Jewish Folk Tales, and then Julian is desperately trying to submit these immoral fairy tales to the Paris Review. And then in Iris's letter to B, she confesses that Marvin took away the yellow fairy book, replacing it with How Electricity Works, which strikes me as a very glum proposition. And near the end of the book, you have Leo saying, forget the fairy books, in real life, nightingales sing no better than crows. It's almost as if part of the problem, and one of the reasons why these characters are often so mean, is because they're being denied their fairy tales. They're being denied their ability to even reconstruct their fairy tales. And I'm curious how the fairy tale component developed in the course of four.
Well, I think fairy tales matter because they, well, as I said, I guess at the beginning of this conversation, that this Jamesian plot is in fact a fairy tale plot, a folktale plot. The wayward, younger, dismissed, disparaged son, usually a son, goes out into the world to seek his fortune, and then strange things will occur. There's always in the fairy tale the happy ending. But with the happy ending for Cinderella, say, there is the very unhappy ending of the three sisters being put in a barrow filled with pitch and stuck all over inside with spikes and rolled down a hill.
Yeah.
The glory of the Teutonic imagination. you know, you've touched on something which really devours me with chagrin. And that's how people respond. I noticed this in the so-called customer reviews.
Oh, you read those?
Well, I read them. Well, I don't have many, so I have no, I don't have many to read. But I read them for books that I'm interested in to see how readers read, and this is an overriding thing, and it really touches on whether American culture has the capacity to integrate what we call the tragic. Because the biggest complaint always is, I don't like the characters. I hate the characters. They bring me no joy. They're dislikable. So then, how can you read Kafka?
Yeah.
How can you read King Lear? How can you read King Lear? I mean, if that, and this is a shoddy novel because the characters are so despicable, well, then Shakespeare is a shoddy writer.
Yeah.
So is Kafka. And that, I mean, that
so
is.
So is James. I have to say, I read The Ambassadors and I couldn't stand Strether. I thought, I just was like, come on, dude, you've had 6 months on the ship to think this thing through, and this is what you do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't think you would throw the book out.
No,
as a result
of that. Kept reading.
No, and I hope you valued it.
I did. I had my issues with it, I will confess.
What are your issues?
Well, my issues were largely...
Your Jamesian issues.
Well, they're Jamesian issues. A lot of it is actually the sentences. I will confess that that there were some times where I, you know, and it may have been, I was reading, I believe, the New York edition. I think that might have had something to do with it, which had been edited and edited to death to the point where the sentences were rather enormous beasts that
he worsened them.
Yeah, he worsened them. In fact, I would tell you this. I even had a dream where I had a stroke after reading Henry James. I don't know what that means, but I think a lot of it had to do with the sentences. But nevertheless, I was compelled to keep reading, and I was interested enough in what was going on. But it was the sentences, and it was also a very unlikely quality that I don't particularly care for, which is, for goodness sakes, you know, be a man and go ahead and just go ahead and say, I want to live this way. But no, it's about like constant observation, constant seeing, constant looking. But we look at like the Williamsburg hipster where we're from, and we see similar situations among 20-somethings who are these wayward spirits who live and don't even live. They just basically like drift around. So it's an ongoing predicament, and it's interesting to see it in the context of a comparatively late book, 1903.
Well, that's the point, because the early James, first of all, the prose is so lucid by comparison.
Yeah.
I mean, Washington Square, and there are these great stories like The Beast in the Jungle, which is convoluted because it's later. But it really is about being convoluted. The Beast in the Jungle is James unconsciously, I believe, critiquing his late style. But then there's The Madonna of the Future, which is a great story about the nature of art. Four Cousins, I believe. I haven't got that title quite right, but these early stories are they're actually pellucid. The prose is lucid. The characters are defined and definitive. They don't keep you waffling the way Strether does. So there are really two Jameses, and he always gets stuck with the later James. But the later James is and by the way, he's a comedian, because the early stories are quite comical, and the later James is convoluted and he's lost in this maze. But The Beast in the Jungle is about a a man so lost in the maze of his own convolutions that he never lives.
Yeah.
So that
same theme as Strether.
Yes. Exactly. It goes together. Those two are twins. Yeah. That's long story in that novel, right?
Isn't it? I'm curious, since we're on the subject of the Ambassadors, you pursued music instead of the theater, which is a big element in the Ambassadors. Mm. Would you say that you're theatrically illiterate? Or?
Well, no. I've had quite an education in theater because I did have a play put on.
I know that. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yes. So that was my theatrical education, and I certainly learned the difference between theater and a novel, and these are antithetical because one depends so much on, as they say, collaboration, and the other is so insulated and isolated and so on your own. Maybe that's what those necks mean, you know, just as I said, the noose, you're just hanging by a thread and you're all by yourself, and there's no safety net below, and you feel it in the neck. You're getting it in the neck.
That seems a really great way to close this lovely conversation. Cynthia, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It was a joy.
Yes, I ran to the fire.